is Radio City. John Grayson here with you alongside Rob Ross, Pop Dose writer. And of course, you see his name all over the new music section on Pop Dose each and every week. And the two of us get together to talk over some of the latest. And Rob, how's everything going?
So far, so good. How about you, John? How are you doing?
Fantastic. We got to see a little live music last night. We'll talk about that in just a couple. And life is good. So we're going to jump right in with Pop Dose this week and start with some new music that you reviewed for the site. And there's one in particular that I thought was just fascinating, a band that you introduced us to via Pop Dose called Danger Muffin. Who are these guys?
They're one of those jam bands. I really don't like that phrase.
Yeah, I know.
It's very unfair and very pigeonholing automatically. But okay, they're considered to be a jam band.
Mm-hmm.
But this is now, I think, their fourth or fifth album. And they're from South Carolina. They're from Charleston. You know what? I'm wrong. It's their sixth album. Sorry, I needed to consult my notes for a second. They're from Charleston, South Carolina. I received the album. I gave it a listen. I wouldn't consider this a jam band. I would consider it more like Americana, with grooves, but they also incorporate the Appalachian style of finger picking and a little bit of Jamaican reggae and a vibe to it. That
yes.
It's just a wonderfully heady, delicious musical mix.
Yeah, you know what I found great about it is that they dip into so many different styles, and they seem comfortable in them all. It's not in a way of showing off, hey, look, we can do this too. It's just, we wanted to write a song that sounded like this, and here it is.
Right. It's something that you and I talked about a couple of times over the last few weeks, the whole notion of a band not trying to put themselves into a certain style or bracket, but doing things organically. And the other thing that I find really interesting is that to go along with the music itself, their lyrics fit the actual songs in the sense of there's a linking theme about the human connection to our ancestry.
Yes.
You know, our traditions and a certain amount of desire or yearning for humanity to get back to its roots because, you know, at this particular moment, I think that's a concept that, albeit maybe a little on the more wishful side, is something that people can use in an effort to hold on to a sense of optimism.
Right.
Icebox, icebox, oh, lock things inside. But let me remind you of one thing. To go get it out, tip it back on the upswing. Oh, icebox, don't be so cold.
And I think that this band brings a lot of comfort with this new album, Heritage. And I think the album title, you know, says it all, and it makes a lot of sense. But musically speaking, I mean, yeah, there are different styles here, but it all works. It's all the same band, and you can tell it's the same band. You know, case in point, it starts with a gospel-style piece, right?
Yeah.
But then you get a bit more tropical on a song called Waves, which absolutely makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
Then, you know, there's a really personal moment, and that's one of the things I like about this record. It is personal. There's a track called One Last Swim, and it's about a friend of theirs, a percussionist, who had passed away. And, you know, it's that kind of heartfelt tribute that you get the message and the impact upon listening to the song.
Right. Yeah, it shows a little maturity as songwriters.
Absolutely. And you know, the fact that they have been around now for six albums, that's pretty good. And they've honed their craft so well that it shows that there's really nothing that this band isn't capable of doing musically and lyrically.
Yeah.
And I think that's very comforting and reassuring. Now, the great thing is, even though it's six albums overall, this is the first one that, you know, that certainly I'm aware of. So hopefully it will lead to even bigger because their name is getting out there.
Yes, yes, indeed. And again, that album is called Heritage, and the review is up elsewhere on popdose.com from Danger Muffin. So go check these guys out. They're really talented, and they're having a good time doing what they do. And by the way, vocally, they also sound terrific. And it's not, you know, there are some layered harmonies, but again, they don't overdo it. So if that's your thing, by all means, get yourself all imbued in this one. And we move from there into another band. This one's called Blonde Redhead, and they've got an EP out now called 3 o'clock. Take us back again through who they are.
They're a New York-based trio. They've been around for about 20 years.
Mm-hmm.
And this latest EP is, I think, the first one in 3 years.
Okay.
So I mean, they've been pretty prolific, and I've seen their name for eons, you know, in the papers and in listings of, you know, upcoming shows and so on. But they make this very, well, certainly on this EP, it's a very ambient yet very warmly emotional. And those are words you will not find usually going hand in hand.
Right.
Ambient and emotional. This a very cinematic kind of sound. It really fits. It, I think, automatically soundtrack, European groove, although not, you know, up-tempo dance grooves, but, you know, that kind of slow jam dance groove.
What occurred to me upon first listen to the song that's linked on the page on the review for 3 o'clock is that, and I don't want to make a comparison in that it sounds like, but it would sound right at home next to some of the early stuff like Smooth Operator from Sade. It's in that same sort of category, but I don't tend to gravitate toward that too much. This, however, was because of the fact that it's not sanitized. It had a little bit of extra something that really kind of drew me in.
Reminded me of, if you remember, in the early part, just after it turned into the year 2000, a band called, or a project called, 07.
Yes.
Who just absolutely, that was the album of 2000 as far as I was concerned. Mm-hmm. Simple Thing was their debut. That and there was an album by Massive Attack called Mezzanine. But those seem to be the only two albums I would play over and over and over again. This kind of fits somewhere in that vein. That's how I feel when I hear it.
Right.
Reminds me very much of 07. So, and if you can get into 07, or if you remember that record, well then, I think this is something you definitely want to check out.
Again, a brand new EP from the band Blonde Redhead. It's called 3 O'Clock, and the review, and some music, by the way, so you can get yourself a little bit of video, a little bit of music on the page at popdose.com. Rob Ross and John Grayson here with you, just kind of hanging out, doing some talking on Radio City this week. And we've got a couple of other columns from your fellows at Popdose we want to highlight, starting out with what D.W. Dunphy's got for us, because I have never heard of something like this happening, but apparently there's a burgeoning movement that I think would take a lot of people by surprise that D.W. takes us into. What's he writing about?
He's writing about the VHS subculture. And now, having, you know, had that joy, and this is what I picked up on in this article, the joy of going to, for me, it was going to the record store and then stopping in the video section.
Yep.
Afterwards, to pick up whatever movies I might be interested in, and certainly music video compilations, which were such an important thing. You know, it reminded me of my youth, and that's why I really took to this article really heavily, you know?
Right, and the fact that anybody is going back and doing this, I mean, we're all aware that vinyl is coming back in a big way right now, but there's a reason for that. Vinyl has something that's easy to grab onto as a superiority over digital music. And yeah, it's got its pitfalls as well, but I think that the real audiophiles are the ones who are going after this. With VHS, you can't really make that same case that watching a videotape is a better experience than watching high def.
That's true. And plus the fact that video machines themselves have fallen by the wayside.
Right.
I mean, they're not being made anymore. I still have one. It could work, but when I tried to hook it up to my high def TV, it just really didn't look like anything worth the effort. But,
right,
you know, there's a certain, in reading through this article, there's a certain, I guess, for lack of a better phrase, there's a certain memory and a nostalgia.
You can get
for those times as well. That, you know,
yeah.
Yes. I mean, you think back to when you got your first VHS tapes and how much of a treasure they actually were. Because I can remember the first three that I bought, actually, one of which I bought before I even had my own VHS recorder, you know, a VCR of my own.
Yeah.
which was, believe it or not, the Cure compilation, Staring at the Sea, the videos. And I got that in 19... I was a late bloomer for getting my own VCR, 1986. But the first two movies that I ever bought with my own money was The Hunger and Head.
Oh, and great Head choices. Yeah.
And let me just remind you how expensive those were. You know, that was basically, you know, when you work in a pharmacy like I did at the time, you know, you're making not a lot of money, but that was a special treat, you know.
Right.
And when Head came out, I had to have it. But, you know, and part of the joy was having everybody sitting around with you in front of the TV, because you all wanted to see this movie together, and now you had it, you know.
Right.
It was a moment. It was kind of like you get that album before everybody else does, and you're all sitting around listening to it for the first time. And you're either going to go, this is wonderful, or turn that crap off.
Yeah. You see, we had an opposite experience, because you said you were a late adopter. We were early adopters, because my grandfather bought my dad a top loader RCA VCR for Christmas, bought it really for the whole family, and it was $1,100 at the time. I think it was 1977. And the first thing that we taped off of TV was a tape that hung around our house for probably 20 years afterward. And it was the premiere episode of Mork and Mindy.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow. And that was on VHS, not Beta.
That's right. Yeah, Betamax hadn't come out yet.
We didn't get our first VCR until 1983, but none of us in my house could figure out how to set it up, how to use it properly. Just, you know, we would occasionally tape something and it would come out all botched up somehow.
Right.
But then my parents, God bless them, decided just to buy me my own VCR.
Yep.
Like late 85, early 86. So that's why I was able to get my own cache of tapes. And frankly, the one that they bought me, which I believe was a Samsung, but I'm not sure. It was one of those, at the time, lower budget brands, but now would be considered kind of top of the mark.
Mm-hmm.
But that was a really easy one to be able to figure out how to use in programs. So that's why I was a late bloomer on the personal front. But nevertheless, you know, the whole thing is that, you know, Dunphy goes into many levels about the whole VHS, VCR subculture. But there's something to be taken into account. You know, A, it was of a time.
Right.
B, it bridged something for us. It made accessible something that we either saw in passing that somebody else might have had, B, you could only see it in the theater, or C, you could only see it on cable if you had cable.
Yep.
You know? So that's another avenue to all of this. But, you know, there is also a nostalgia fact. And you know, let's face it, when we were young, it was really cool to have those boxes right underneath the TV.
Mm-hmm.
To see that collection of tapes there.
Right. Right, and it's about cover art as well, the same way as it is for records. So I totally get it, and it's a fascinating article. Again, you got to read what D.W. Dunphy's got in his column about the VHS movement, and it's much, much smaller than the vinyl movement right now, but it is growing, and according to the people who are really into it, they're looking forward to watching it grow even more.
You know, and there is one more thing to think about. I mean, there are things that I have on VHS that have never been out on DVD.
Yeah, true.
I'll give you perfect example, and two perfect examples that are incredibly glaring ones. The Virgin Records compilation of XTC's videos that go from This Is Pop all the way through to Senses Working Overtime. That's never appeared on any kind of DVD form. And the Buzzcocks playback, the documentary that was released on IRS video in 1992. I'm surprised that has not appeared on
DVD yet. Yeah, well, we'll know that it's coming. We'll know that the VHS movement has really gained some steam when we start to see a collector's market for some of the rare VHS tapes of old. So keep your eye on eBay for that. So a great point. And I'm going to have to go through my collection now and see if I've got anything that never did come out. I bet there's a couple of them in there. But the other column that we wanted to spotlight this week comes to us from Jack Furyk, and he's been writing a series of columns under the banner Too Old to Rock and Roll, Too Young to Die, which, by the way, is my favorite Jethro Tull song. But this is a very personal story for him as well. Talk a little bit about what he's been going through.
Well, he's decided, as many of us have, after years of not playing and having, for lack of a better phrase, real life, take the wheel, to get back to playing and being in a band and writing songs and making music again. And I just found it really, really interesting, the way he describes his taking the time during the Valentine's Day weekend to start to get things going with his new amp and breaking things in, you know.
And rattling windows.
yeah, I mean, the most poignant thing I found was that my calluses came back. I said about rebuilding my chops, because every time I play, my hands hurt.
Yep.
You know, my 38-year calluses are gone from my own hands.
Mm-hmm.
You know, my fingers are now, dare I say, soft and normal. So the dexterity is not as good as it used to be. The length of time that I can play is not what it was. So I can completely relate to all of this.
Yeah. And there's something that happens. I mean, there is that feeling when you start to see those tubes glow again and you really start to get into it. And the best part about this latest edition, which is edition number 3 of Too Old to Rock and Roll, Too Young to Die, is that Jack was kind enough to link a song that he wrote and performed, and it's right there for you on the page. So you can listen to a little bit of what he's doing while he's getting himself back ready to go out on stage.
And I love the fact that it was his first new song around the time he started looking to play again.
Yep.
And sort of a call to arms, as it were. And the thing is that for somebody like me who labors over and frets over even demos to the point of going, okay, that's not any good.
Yep.
You know, I think it's a credit to him for just getting it out and down and there for us to listen to, you know. But the fact that he even shared with us his online ad in Craigslist.
Right.
You know?
Yeah, and it's something that, you know, again, it's a little bit of humanizing, because we all do these things. We're all involved in this. We all have had those things that whatever it is that you're into, when you get back into it, you start to find out that there's a whole new world out there because of the internet and those little fits and starts of ways that you kind of dip your toe back into the water. It's something that, you know, again, we've all been through. It makes it all make sense. It brings it all home to us, I think.
Well, I'll tell you something. As a little sidebar to all of this, it reminds me of when my old band, The Punchline, had first gotten back together in 2003, 2004,
mm-hmm.
after being apart since 1992. Just in the brief amount of time that we were back together from 2003 till about 2006, we went further just by virtue of word of mouth getting around on the internet and being able to promote our album on the websites that we had set up. You know, if the internet had been around when we were at our best, as it were, back in 86, 87, 88,
yeah.
You know, who knows what could have happened. But yeah, it's a completely brave new world with the internet being there for you and the way that you can connect with musicians who are, in fact, like-minded.
Right.
That's when you have to look at the net as being an aid for bands, not as a hindrance, because I know that there are so many scams and very, very questionable, I don't know what you want to call them, sites and organizations out there that want to, you know, help bands out for a nominal fee.
Right.
You know, that's bullshit. and it's a crime. The way to do it is very simple. You find the musicians, if you click, you have a band. You record something, you put it on a website of your own, you have the direct connection. Something you and I have talked about before.
Yep.
I put out the album, you want to buy it, you buy it directly from me, we're both happy.
Yeah, and that's what builds the commercial part of it, and it also allows the artist to keep eating, which unfortunately Spotify and a lot of the streaming services don't. You have to rely on that, you're screwed. So,
it also keeps the bands in a really good vein with their fans, knowing
yep.
that they're not out to screw the fans like the record companies or these questionable organizations and nebulous companies that pop up that, you know, we have X, Y, and Z for you from, you know, this band, that band, and the other band.
Right.
You know, but they don't deliver on it.
And there's a universality about it too, and this is what I was getting to before, is that, you know, my son, who is now 22, has decided that he wanted to learn how to drive a stick, and so he went out and bought one, an old car, not old, but mid-90s, and got a car with a standard shift for a couple of $100, and it needs some work. Well, because the internet is there, anything you want to know about something like that, you can find people who have already had that problem and dealt with it, and they can tell you how. If you're a collector of model trains, whatever it is you're into, that's there. There's a community there that's there to back you up.
Exactly.
It's great.
That's using the net for all the right reasons,
yep,
for the right purposes.
Exactly. Right. And again, it's all about that direct connection. Beautiful stuff. And again, read Too Old to Rock and Roll, Too Young to Die. If you haven't already, start back with episode one and then just follow Jack as he goes back through this adventure, because it's really a very cool thing. He also talks about, as a Western New Yorker, the fact that he's in a town that's not a huge city, and the challenges that that presents as well. So definitely one that you're going to want to read and send to your friends as well. So always something new happening on popdose.com. You already know that. And Rob Ross, John Grayson here with you, talking over some of the latest. There's also a few things we wanted to kind of kick around a little bit. And there's one last Popdose column that, again, Ken Shane has done it to us one more time. Soul Serenade is always quality. And again, you get added content there on the page. You get the song along with Ken Shane's description and memories of it. Where does he take us this time?
Well, it's a song I think you remember as well as I do, "Clean Up Woman" by Betty Wright.
Great tune.
And it's, you know, yeah, exactly. And you know, the funny thing is, and I have to say this because it's going to be so glaringly obvious if we didn't talk about it, it is so almost identical. I bet you people will confuse it with another song that came out literally at the same time, "Mr. Big Stuff" by,
yep,
Gene Knight.
Right, and with echoes of Soul Man in it too. Sure.
You know, so, but the thing is, I remember this song so well. You know, it was, as we always mention, we are kids of AM radio.
Yep.
We are products of the late 60s, early 70s. And, you know, I remember this song being on, you know, ABC AM or whatever the hell my parents had on at the time.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I was maybe, what, 6, 7 years old when it came out?
Yeah.
And, you know, at an early age, when you know you're into a groove of some kind or another, this is one of those songs that, you know, make a little 6-year-old kid hop up and down or do that weird little twist that 6-year-olds do. I love the fact that he plucked the song out, but then he gave an even bigger and better breakdown of what she did afterwards. Once again, it goes to Ken's credit for being such a scholar about all of this, because, you know, as well you know, my love of soul music is an ongoing, lifelong thing. Of course, my main obsessions are that of Stax and what the British term as Northern Soul, but, you know, really it's just obscure soul music that never became hits here, but became big floor stompers, you know, dance floor stompers over there.
Right. And, you know, I'm so glad you brought up that age group of, you know, the 6, 7, 8-year-olds when we were first starting to consume music, when we first really kind of got it, that there were people that were behind making these great records, that music just didn't, you know, come out of the walls. And it's funny because we came at it at that point from such an innocence. And I don't know if you share this with me, but the funny thing about, you know, going back and reading Ken's column is a lot of times I'll think of songs I haven't thought of or heard in 40
exactly.
years.
Exactly.
And when they hit me, I'll remember it from that 6-year-old or 7-year-old standpoint. And
exactly.
The first thing that occurs to me is, we had no idea what most of these people looked like, you know, so there was no race, there was no color, there was no anything in that to us, because what would a 6-year-old be thinking about that for?
I'm going to give you a couple of perfect examples. The first time I ever heard this song was on a transistor radio outside our local Dairy Queen in the summer of 71.
Uh-huh.
And I can, as strange as it sounds, I can remember saying to my mom, because it was my first attempt as a 6-year-old to have a banana split. And I said to my mother, "Is this a new record by the Beatles?" And my mother said, "No, the Beatles broke up last year." And I said, "Is this Paul McCartney?" And she goes, "Yes." And it was the first time that I'd ever heard Uncle Albert, Admiral Halsey.
Oh, wow.
Now, let's throw a couple of other songs that I can tell you immediate images that I get. And the most lasting one of all is the picture of myself, cousins Valerie and Leslie, who were sisters, the three of us in my parents' red with brown paper siding Opel Kadett wagon driving around with my parents up front. These songs always seemed to come on the radio whenever we were together in the car. Come and Get Your Love by Redbone.
Yes.
The Last Song by Edward Baer, which every time I hear it makes me want to cry, no matter what, even now. Anything by Elton John stretching between that period from Daniel till Someone Saved My Life Tonight.
Yeah.
Any single that Elton put out, it didn't matter. Show and Tell by Al Wilson. Run, Joey, Run by David Geddes. Billy, Don't Be a Hero.
Yep.
Tonight Chicago Died.
Right.
Tell Me Something Good by Rufus.
Yeah. And, you know, at the time, the radio station that I was listening to, the AM radio station that I was listening to all of that early 70s pop on, and you mentioned, I mean, yeah, bands like Bo Donaldson and the Haywoods, and the Night Chicago, that was what, Paper Lace, right?
Yep.
And who else was out there? There was a band called Stars, a New York-based band, STARZ, featuring guitarist Richie Rano, who I think at one point was a member of Looking Glass that did Brandy. And there was this song called Sing It, Shout It. They used to play endlessly in Western New York. Loved that tune. And, you know, with all of that great radio that was going on at the time, the station I was listening to was WKBW, and they had this jingle package that was their own, you know, and it was the same kind of pop style. They even had their own theme song, and it was, and I can remember all of that stuff word for word, even though it hasn't been heard on the radio again in probably 40 years.
Well, that's the thing. We grew up with something that we'll always remember.
Great radio,
it's,
yeah.
It's not dissimilar to what our parents grew up with, because I remember my parents, you know, when we would just sit around together and have the literal family time. And, you know, my parents would tell me what, you know, what TV and radio is like in the 50s. And, you know, like, my parents would occasionally sing jingles from back then together. You know, their memories became things that I became interested in learning about. And subsequently, because of the period that we grew up with, I think a lot of that was the carryover from that era.
Yeah.
It wasn't really very different. You know, there were commercials that were on in the early 70s that still ran from the 60s. You know, and certainly we were always deluged with TV from the 60s. You know, I remember whenever I was sick from school, which I was a lot in grade school, it was always the same thing. Cartoons until 9 and then reruns of Gomer Pyle and I Love Lucy and, you know, what have you. And then around 4 o'clock, the Monkees were on, and then Lost in Space and my favorite Martian, you
right.
know?
Right. Do you remember a cartoon called Wait Till Your Father Gets Home?
Of course I do, with William Wyndham as the William Wyndham and Tom Bosley is the father,
right.
And Pamela Burden was the daughter.
Yeah. Just
wait
fantastic.
Until your father gets home.
Oh, man, that's great. So, and that's what I'm talking about. Even that KB jingle, it was called We Belong Together, and I could sing the whole thing for you. I won't. I will spare you that, but I can sing the whole thing for you.
Well, I did it, so therefore, you know, you have
boy.
No reason to listen.
All right, good deal. Rob Ross, John Grayson here with you. It's called Radio City, and of course, we come your way every week here on Pop Dose. And, you know, you led into that with Paul McCartney, and again, we were talking about Ken Shane's Soul Serenade column. Go read that. Listen to the song. It's there for you. Just click. And you mentioned Paul McCartney and the connection that you had with him in 1971. I want to go a little bit later on, because in our heads segment for this week, the one song that was in my head, because out of nowhere, my phone just decided to play it while I was riding in the car the other day, is a song called Picasso's Last Words off of Band on the Run. And that song, I hadn't heard it in a very, very long time, because usually, you know, if something comes on from Band on the Run, it's Band on the Run or 1985. And so listening back to that song and the clarity and the beautiful production on that piece, it brought back to me again the fact that here's McCartney going back to sort of his Irish pub roots, you know, with the beginning of that song. And then it leads right into a sort of a callback to Jet, only in a kind of toned down, almost bongo drum, you know, kind of feel to it.
Thank you.
brilliant at that, at being able to bring back riffs, bring back little pieces of music. That's what Side 2 of Abbey Road was all about. And it was, again, it was a whole new experience for me as a now 47-year-old, listening back to a song that I really probably haven't heard much since I was a kid. It was great.
Well, Picasso's last words, drink to me, drink to my health. You know I can't drink anymore.
Yep.
What you just said about McCartney being able to stitch those kinds of songs together, he was a master of the suite.
Right.
Or the mini symphony in a single song.
Mm-hmm.
And, yeah, you know, when you listen to Band on the Run, you sometimes do tend to... I hate to say it, but the three songs I probably tend to skip with some consistency on Band on the Run, which is one of my favorite albums of all time, which I think we also talked about last week.
Yeah.
But Picasso's Last Words, No Words, and Bluebird are the three songs I do tend to skip.
Yeah.
Because look what else is on that album, Band on the Run and Jet Aside.
Right.
This is Vanderbilt. Let Me Roll It. Helen Wheels. 1985. I mean, really.
Right.
Oh, and Mamounia, which is one of the most gorgeous things McCartney ever did and always gets criminally overlooked. But, I mean, that album is just flawless and brilliant.
Right.
The thing is that it's a very odd, and that's another thing McCartney was very good at and never got the accolades due him. He could take the weirdly avant-garde. Something like, you know, reading that Picasso's last words were allegedly drink to me, drink to my health, you know I can't drink anymore, and then putting it into a song and doing it as a suite. You know, that takes some kind of ingenuity and talent. And I don't think he's ever gotten the right amount of accolades or respect for being able to do that with such skill.
Yeah.
You know, to have Dustin Hoffman on that track and the different movements of that track.
Right. And it does. It goes through three or four, maybe five different movements in it. And, you know, the callback was something also that happened in 1985, because right at the end of that song, what does it do? Goes right back to the chorus of Band on the Run.
Right.
Yeah.
It's that wonderful, explosive return to what it does is it basically makes it a complete cycle. It does make it a concept album, really, because if you think about it, Sgt. Pepper, you know, going back into the Sgt. Pepper reprise, which leads into the grand finale of A Day in the Life.
Yep, right. And it's all the more reason why McCartney deserves all of the accolades for the genius that he had. But, you know, moving forward, you hear echoes of that in kind of the strangest places, because you mentioned the concept album, and I still think it's arguable that this is one, but if you listen hard enough, and you don't even have to listen to it that hard, really, but if you listen to Dark Side of the Moon from beginning to end, how often do they call back to that E minor and A major? And it goes on at the end of the song Time. It calls right back to the beginning of the album, and it's just, you know, again, it's a stitch that blends through, even those songs
the
like Money
Are. I mean, if somebody's going to argue that, then they're probably going to lose the argument, because I think it is meant to be and stands up as a singular piece of work.
Yes.
You know, that was the whole point with Roger Waters, you know, Right Through to the Wall. It's always a conceptual work.
Right.
So it's going to be a concept album. You know, people tried to hang that on the Jam with Setting Suns. And Weller himself will say, well, I had three or four songs that I wanted to stitch together, but I just couldn't be bothered. In the end, I said, fuck it, you know? And that's exactly how it went. But people wanted to see it as a concept album. You know, it works for about three or four songs, but those songs aren't linked together one after the other, after the other, after the other. Well, maybe two of them are. Certainly Private Hell and Thick as Thieves are.
Yeah.
But, you know, Burning Sky, Little Boy Soldiers, Wasteland, those songs would fit the concept had the concept stayed, but, you know, putting in a version of Heatwave didn't really help. Feet and Rifles was a good piece, but lyrically it doesn't fit the theme of, you know, three old friends going in three separate directions.
Right.
The left wing, the right wing, and the center. But, you know, since this is the you know, in our heads segment, this is something I was thinking about, because it's become a really big thing that we're definitely cognizant of, I'd say now for at least the last, I want to say dozen years, it may be longer than that, but I'll give it a firm dozen years. Hearing songs that you would never in a billion years expect to hear, you just happen to hear it in the corner of the room or whatever, and you realize it's coming out of commercial.
Yeah.
And it's a song that you're never going to even pick up. It's like, what the fuck? Because right now there is, I think it's either an iPhone or a Samsung or an AT&T commercial, and they're using the Monks. Where did that come from? You know?
Yeah, and of course, I mean, it all started with Revolution in the Nike commercial, right?
For me, it really, when I and I'm talking about the sheer sit up and take notice and go, are you kidding me?
Yeah.
Was when What Do I Get was used in a Toyota commercial. Okay.
Yeah.
So that was the first warning shot, because right after that there was some, I don't know, Call of Duty, Grand Theft Auto, some fucking video game, and they used Gotta Get Away by Stiff Little Fingers as the background music.
Yeah.
Right?
Uh-huh.
And then later on, and I'm skipping several years, and we're sitting there and this Cadillac commercial comes on, and all of a sudden this incredibly familiar, and when I say familiar, my tongue is firmly planted in my cheek, guitar solo comes in, and I just looked at Liz and I was like, are you fucking kidding me? And it was Start by The Jam.
on a Cadillac commercial. On the
Cadillac
least likely of all.
Just, you know, none of the, you know, what you give is what you get part, just the with the guitar solo going
right
over it. And I'm sitting there going, holy shit.
Yeah. Well, and
but then to hear The Creation, Make in Time, being used, and I think it was a Miller Lite commercial.
Yep.
You know, it's this kind of thing that makes me go, wow.
Yeah.
We're the generation that our songs, the songs that we know and are very personal to us, they're the ones that are being tossed out there now for commercial consumption.
Right. And Rock and Roll by Led Zeppelin was also, if I believe, used in a Cadillac commercial years ago. And it's funny, the one that sticks out to me is one that probably almost nobody has ever heard of. There's a guy who's how to classify Devendra Banhart. He's a singer-songwriter, but he's a real weirdo in kind of the best way. I mean, I really dig what he does, but he has a song called Little Yellow Spider, and it was used to sell, I want to say it was Fat Tire beer. If not, it was something like that. It was, you know, it was a beer commercial for one of the kind of off brands or, you know, microbrews. And the funny thing about that is that I heard the song before I heard the commercial. And when I heard it on the commercial, what it brought back is the part that they didn't use. One of the lines in that song is, hey, you little sexy pig, you made it with a man, and now you've got a little kid with hooves instead of hands. And I thought, you know, that doesn't really make me want a beer.
So, wow.
Yeah, right. And it's like, you got to be careful about that. You know, there are songs like Death or Glory by The Clash. That's a great tune. It's a terrific, you know, nice driving jam. And there's a line in there that says, he who fucks nuns will later join the church. So, you know, you use that in a commercial, you're taking your life in your hands.
Very true. But I mean, the thing is that, you know, people are going to take those songs and use them in commercials.
Right.
They think it helps. You know, listen, there used to be this great agency in New York that their whole bag was trying to get good/cool songs for commercial use.
Yep.
And I sent them a couple of submissions of ideas, like for the Venus Razor, Hey Venus by That Petrol Emotion.
Right.
Oh, I mean, how apt.
That's funny.
You know, so it can be done tastefully. It really can, but you know, just sitting there hearing the Monks, because let's face it, that you're really going into left field when you're listening to a band like the Monks,
yeah,
who, to me, I think they're brilliant as they're hysterical. But to see the, dare I say, lame-brained and goofy nature of the commercial, that's kind of what made my teeth set on edge.
Yeah.
If I'm going to be honest, I don't mind hearing Start being used in a Cadillac commercial, because Cadillac is Cadillac, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, that's true. And some of them, I mean, you get songs that are, that get popular because of the commercials. This Ride the Lightning Bolt song that's played endlessly on TV now. I don't even remember what, honestly, the ads are for, but I remember that song, and I went out and investigated it and downloaded it because I heard it.
That's a good point, because remember when Apple came out with the iPod Mini?
Yeah.
Remember the song that they used, You Jerk It Out?
Yes.
The Seizures. As it turned out, that was during a period when I was working at a, no pun intended, a temporary slash stop the bleeding kind of job to make ends meet. And I was working as a security guard at the Gap.
Yeah.
And we used to have this wonderful loop of what became, it was, believe it or not, from Muzak, but it was amazing stuff. And there was a different song by the Seizures that was on there called Cracking Up Over You. The thing about that is, you know, because I liked that song so much, I went out and bought the Seizures record, not even realizing that Jerk It Out was also them and on that same album, 39 Minutes of Recorded Bliss.
Nice. Yeah.
So you see, because that was a great song and a memorable song. And I thought, well, fucking A, you know, that's a nice little surprise that, you know, this great song from the commercial happens to be, you know. But then on the flip side, how many of these goddamn commercials are going to use Lust for Life?
Yeah,
you know,
right.
I hear that drum roll, and all I see is Renton and Sick Boy and Spud running. That's it. The only image that comes to my mind.
As it
not
should
easy,
be.
Nothing else.
Yeah.
Just that.
And by the
choose
way,
life.
I'm glad. Yeah, right. Exactly. I'm glad you mentioned that because you happen to be in one of the markets where Trainspotting 2 is already out, and the rest of us are still waiting for it as it's making its slow release across the country. I've heard very little about it, and I don't know whether to be scared or thankful.
So far, I've only seen one thing from one person, and he it was very cryptic, and he said, "Is a completely perplexing movie."
I'm okay with that as long as, you know, as long as it has the same guts that the first one did, I'm okay with perplexing. So we'll keep our fingers crossed.
I remember seeing that first one and loving every minute of it.
Oh, yeah.
I don't know why, because it was such a harrowing film, but it was so brilliant. And of course, the person I was with just sat there and said, oh, this is just disgusting and this is horrible. And I said,
yep.
Yeah, well, you're also the same person that made me sit my ass in a theater for 3 hours on Christmas watching fucking Titanic. So I'd rather watch these assholes shoot heroin than have to sit and watch those two.
Yeah, and I'm going to go off on another tear here because, yes, it was harrowing, and yes, it was disgusting, and yeah, there were a lot of parts of that movie that were really hard to watch of Trainspotting. There was a lot of it that was just goofball humor, and that was fun, but there's some stuff in that movie that's really hard to watch, but you know what? If they didn't have the guts to go that far with those scenes, the movie would have fallen apart. It's the same reason, and I have this argument with people all the time now about Blazing Saddles. You know, oh, there's so much racism in the movie. Yeah, but if those people aren't dyed-in-the-wool, N-word-flinging racists, you know, then they're not that bad, and the movie doesn't make any sense.
Them's docket and we are.
Exactly. Lows and gain.
My sugar in it.
Oh, yeah. So, but, they, you know, that's the point. And sometimes you have to bash people over the head with that before they get it. But I still think that movie went exactly the right amount into that story. So
I will say I would like to see Trainspotting 2. I have my cautions and concerns.
Yep.
And, you know, it's not like going to see, for argument's sake, I know it's a stretch. Well, maybe not because of Ewan McGregor. But, you know, going to see Star Wars 30 years later.
Yeah.
You know, The Force Awakens is one thing. Trainspotting 2, it's just iffy.
Yep.
I mean, I may dip my toe in the water. I'm not sure yet, but I'll keep you posted on that one.
Thank you.
And now here's breaking news for you because of the Final Four weekend. North Carolina beats Kentucky on a final second shot.
Wow. Well, poor Ashley Judd. She's going to be in tears. But, you know, we're going to get...
Well, that's why I was going for UK, obviously.
Yeah. Oh,
the
she's such a sweetheart.
The only reason why I ever do...
Yep. Well, we're going to go much farther into sports. And, you know, there was one thing that I wanted to talk to you a little bit about, and this was actually your idea, is the World Baseball Championships. And I remember seeing a little bit from the final game because Yadier Molina, living in St. Louis now, or at least in the area, got to follow the hometown guys. And Yadi did very, very well. But unfortunately, for him anyway, his team came up just a little bit shy.
Yeah, and this is the first time that the United States has won the World Baseball Classic, which I think is terrific.
Yep.
You know, it's great. Listen, this is one of the two best stories of the entire tournament. The other one was basically the Cinderella story of the Israeli baseball team, because they made it through most of the competition when they weren't even supposed to place.
Right.
You know, and these guys were really a ragtag team made up of, 99% American players?
Right.
So, you know, to see how far they were able to go in this, they made them viable. And I think it's terrific. I think it's terrific for the sport. I think it's terrific for the sport over there. And I think it's great for their national team. You know, so that was one. But to see our team win, and that they won big in that last game,
yep,
that was really heartwarming. So, you know, congratulations to the American baseball team. I'm really happy for them.
No doubt about it. And we've got just a couple of minutes for our sad goodbyes and fond farewells this week. And I want to hand it over to you again for the first one, because it takes us to a place that you've haunted. Tell us about what's going on with Maxwell's.
Well, you know, funnily enough, Maxwell's started off this whole thing between you and I, because our first conversation was what happened. Actually, I never did tell the end of that story. When we had our first conversation in August 2013, it was about the closing of Maxwell's and what a big deal it was.
Yeah.
And the fact that something happened to me that night at Maxwell's during the closing. So I will tell the end of that story now, actually.
Yeah, you ended up on stage.
Right. I didn't tell that part of the story when we did the conversation.
That's funny. But
I'll get to that in a minute. The place was closed, and then somebody decided, maybe 6-7 months later, we were at this point into 2014, somebody bought it, reopened it. They gutted the actual room where bands would play. They changed it. You know, they dismantled the stage, et cetera, et cetera. Mm-hmm. And they'd been running it, you know, in a very ham-handed manner, if I have to be honest. You know, the way that they went about advertising themselves did not set well with the older guard, if you will, and so on. But now it seems that Maxwell's is yet again up for sale. So it looks like that they haven't been able to fulfill the ideas and promises that they had made of, you know, making Maxwell's remain part of the community, and that they were going to pour everything that they could into it. Maybe they have, and they've just run out of money. I don't know. I don't want to castigate anybody, you know, and be wrong, but, you know, it is up for sale once again.
Yeah.
So who knows if this may be yet again the last hurrah. But, you know, the last hurrah to me was that night that I was there, July 31st, 2013.
So what happened? Who were you with?
So I went there as a guest of the Bongos, and I went there and I got into the room, you know, and it was an amazing, as I told you that night, it was an amazing feeling in the club and in the street, because it was a block party, it was a celebration. The Bongos came on after they came on as their original incarnation, A, which was, it was them with Glenn Morrow, who later went on to form the Individuals and Rage to Live, and then Barn on Records. They did their set as A, then they came on as the Bongos. They did an amazing set, and I mean an amazing set. And there were two points where I actually started to cry. One was when they talked about how many times that they had played there and how many times, God knows, I saw them there from the time I was a teenager. And they talked about, you know, the recent, at that point, passing of Faye Hunter, who had been the bass player in Let's Active. And that just made me kind of lose it. But long story short, that morning I got a text from Frank Giannini, the drummer, who is a very, very dear friend. He's like a brother to me. And he texted me and he said, listen, the very last song that we're going to do on stage tonight at Maxwell's is Thank You Friends by Big Star. And we want you to get up and join us. So I'm thinking, I was basically paralytic for most of the day and numb, because, you know, unless it happens, you don't believe it.
Yeah.
And they go through the whole, you know, they brought up guests. They had, Ira from Yola Tango come up on stage. They had Glenn Mercer from the Feelies come up on stage. You know, all these wonderful people were up on stage. You know, Nick Celeste had joined them for a couple of songs during the set. Now he was back up on stage. And when I saw Nick before the show, after we were talking and finished greeting each other, he goes, "I'm going to be up there on stage tonight with the bongos." And I'm thinking to myself, "Yeah, so am I." But I kept my mouth shut. Because like I said, until it actually happens. And then they got to that last song, and Richard starts introducing it, and Frank waves me up onto the stage.
Yeah.
And I go off, and yeah, it really happened. There I was, because the running joke for all these years had always been with the punchline, Maxwell's will always be there. I'm the only one who never played Maxwell's, it seems. All my ex-bandmates and whatever other bands they played in, they played at Maxwell's.
Yeah.
Everybody played Maxwell's except for me, and now it was never going to happen. But there I am on stage that night with the bongos, the night that Maxwell's is closing, doing a song by Big Star.
It does not get any better than that. Yeah, that's one of those memories stay with you forever.
It will, to my grave, in the best possible way. When things are bad and I'm at my lowest emotional ebb, I will think about that, and it will both alternately put tears of joy in my eyes, and it will make me smile and feel just a little bit better.
Attaboy.
You know?
Yeah.
But that, you want to talk about true magic? That was true magic. And that's what, you know, that's what I wrote about in the article that came out a couple of days later. There used to be video footage of this. It was on NJ.com. It has disappeared. I don't know where it went or how it just evaporated, but it is no longer available, which is a shame. But yeah, there was film footage of it, and it always made me cry, because at the very end, the last thing you see is, after the song is over, is like Richard and I gave each other a hug, and I just get all weepy every time I see it. So
that's great. Well, I'll tell you what, in response, it's nowhere near as big a deal, but next week I'll tell you a little bit about my most memorable moment on stage. So we'll do some reminiscing about that as well. But I want to bring in one more fond farewell and sad goodbye. And this one, I'm not, you know, in the grand scheme of things, I guess I'm not the world's biggest fan of corporate rock. It's nowhere near grunge in my hatred of subgenres, but I never just really got into it that much. I was onto different things by the time that was really hitting full stride. But Boston is always a band that sort of stood head and shoulders above that, because, yeah, they fit into that realm, but they were also incredibly talented guys. And one of the original members, no longer with Boston now for the last, decade or so, but Sib Hashin died on stage during a rock and roll cruise. And
playing drums.
He was playing the drums, doing what he loved to do. And, you know, you never want to see something like that happen, but then you realize, what better way to go out than doing what you absolutely live to do?
It's true. It's very sad. And, it of course, it's going to be a shock to those viewing this. But, you know, if you're going to go, what better way? I mean, really, is there any other way to phrase it?
Yeah.
Is there any other way to try and analyze it? I think it would be kind of foolish, because that's exactly it. You're doing what you love to do the most, you know?
Yep.
He wasn't a young man, although, you know, in modern parlance, I guess he was, 67?
I think so, yeah.
You know, 67 is looked upon as not quite old, but, you know, not exactly youthful and as vibrant, but you know what? At least he went out with the sticks in his hand.
No doubt. And
if I was going to go, I would want to go with a guitar,
in
my hand.
No doubt about it. Absolutely. And one last to talk about, my last shot, my sort of parting shot for this week, is that we mentioned way back at the very beginning of this conversation that I got to see a little live music. And a guy that, frankly, I have been a fan of as long as I've been alive, through Buffalo Springfield, which to me was one of those, you know, listen, kid, this is your formative education in music type band. All the way through Poco and Loggins and Messina, and a bunch of solo work that's just outstanding. We got to go see Jim Messina on stage at the Wiley Theater in Edwardsville, Illinois on Saturday night. And you know what? The guy tore it up. His entire band, I mean, they must play a similar show to this probably 100 nights a year, maybe more than that. And they were having a blast in a room full of maybe 300 people. But you know what? Every single one of us was having a blast as well. And he's in fantastic voice. He's still a great guitar picker. And it was a terrific night. We had a ball.
You know, whether it's 300 people, 30 people,
yep,
or 3,000 people, as long as they bring it, that's all that matters. And you can't help but really appreciate and respect a band or a performer that's going to do that. You know, that they're going to basically, whether it's two people or 20,000, they're going to rock it like it's the Enormo Dome. You know, they're going to give you 100% every night. And that's a quote, actually, I got from the late Jim Ellison from Material Issue, because that was his approach.
Yep.
God rest his soul. And, you know, it goes back to what you and I said on our first Radio City broadcast. The older guys still know how to really do it and bring it.
Right.
You know, because they come from that school, that era, that mentality of being professional showmen. You know, yeah, it may be rock and roll and people will laugh it off, but you know what? You're there to do a job, and you're doing a disservice to people who may have traveled to see you because they haven't before, or they've missed seeing you, or whatever it is. But if you go out there and you really give a non-performance, or worse, you fuck it all up,
yeah,
they're not going to forgive that. And if you're that of that age range, then you're doing an even greater disservice, not just to your audience, but to yourself, because now what?
Yeah.
You're not going to be able to get that back.
Well, and the, you know, the perspective, too. I mean, with somebody who's had a career as a producer, as a musician, as a songwriter, as a performer, as Jim Messina has, because, I mean, what he didn't perform on in the 70s, he produced. You know, it's just having that kind of career. And then we just talked to him on my radio show just before the performance, and you know, I ask him about that, about those years with Buffalo Springfield, and the fact that there's a band that was, I think, a six-member affair, and four of them were songwriters. And argument could be made, they were fairly well top-tier songwriters. I mean, you know, when you look at Richie Furay and Jim Messina, not to mention Stephen Stills and Neil Young, these are guys who know how to write tunes. And it's hard to get a cohesive voice out of a band when you've got that many people putting their stamp on it, and somehow they were able to pull it off.
To a degree. I mean, that was a band that was just filled with infighting and
yeah, right, but the music speaks for itself.
Fire.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think, you know, even though they were barely together, and I mean barely together, you know, one of the best things that they ever did was the last album.
Yep.
What was it called? Buffalo Springfield Again?
Right.
Is that the one? The
yes.
one that has I Am a Child.
Right.
The one
right.
where Messina was actually a member of the group, having replaced Bruce Palmer at that point.
Right.
So, you know, that, you know, that we should talk about the Springfield.
We will.
Some of the bands from, you know, there's a couple of bands from that period that we really need to talk about on the show, just to give them a greater light, you know, them or the Lovin' Spoonful. Captain Beefheart and the Magic Band.
Yeah.
You know, those earlier years before everything went completely haywire with Beefheart. You know, just some of those bands, because they made music that lasts.
Right.
Even now, we're talking about 50 plus years.
Right. You know, and I would put the Chambers Brothers in that mix as well. So, yeah, we will do that. We'll run down those lists and start going through some of those bands on upcoming broadcasts. But in the meantime, as we bring this one to a close, what are you going to be writing about this week? What should we be looking for?
There are several video premieres this week, including a new one from the Feelies. We also will talk about, on our next conversation, the latest album from a wonderful singer-songwriter whose name you will recognize, Cindy Lee Berryhill.
Yep.
Just a whole bunch of things that are going on. So I think people need to not only listen to us and to listen to Dave Metzger and read Jack Furyk and everybody else on Popdos, but be checking out the record reviews, because there's a lot of new music happening right now.
Excellent. All right. Well, Rob, always a great conversation, my man. Thank you so much for doing Radio City with us again, and we'll look forward to talking to you next week. I appreciate you being here with us.
All right, brother. You take care of yourself, and I'll talk to you soon.
You do the same. Take care. And be here with us next week when the next edition of Radio City, number 5, I believe, in the tank, will be here for you. So just keep checking it out online at popdos.com. And in the meantime, go look at all the other columns. Have yourself a good time.